This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie Sherman, good Sunday morning.
Scott, always a pleasure. How are we doing today?
We're doing great.
You know, it's another beautiful weekend in Montana, and I had a special thing happen this past week. I think you know about it because it only took me, you know, 60 years of hacking away at it, but I hit a hole in one at the Ranch Club on the fourth hole, and there was nobody to witness it, but I think the staff there believed me after, you know, being there for 10 or 11 years playing golf on that same course. I finally had one bounce, hit the flag in the hole.
Which is amazing, Arnie. You know that.
And well, you had one, what, 3-4 years ago there?
On hole 8.
Yeah, and that's a tougher hole it was a little longer, right? I only had to hit mine 115 yards to put it
in. It's a very hard hole, number 4.
But today, we have one of our favorite guests back.
I want to know. I'm waiting to hear what the pivot is. Where is he going?
Well, here's the pivot. We have our favorite guest back, who is my cousin Eileen.
Yes,
Eileen Waterstone, who for many years
she doesn't golf.
No, who now I jokingly refer to as a pensioner, because she's retired. But after an illustrious career working for originally. For a number of years, Carrie Fisher and Paul Simon, and then when they were divorced, ended up luckily getting into the purview and the orbit of Steve Martin, where she spent the rest of her adult life working until just, you know, very recently. And so she's one of our favorite guests. And the pivot on this is that her father, my uncle, my great uncle, was a lifelong golfer, and used to regale me with golf stories, among many, many other stories. We had him on our show before, before he passed away. And when I hit the hole in one, it would have been nice to tell Uncle Harry that I finally did one after all these years. So
that's sweet.
We have him embodied in Cousin Eileen, and we'll be, I think, regaled with stories of a different kind on the show today.
When we come back, return guest, the return champion, Eileen Waterstone, will be here on What Do You Know? Back after this. All right, Arnie, we are back with our guest, Cousin Eileen Waterstone.
Eileen, it's always good to have you on here. And already, while I was doing the opening with Scott, you were waving on the other side. I didn't see you out of the corner of my eye to correct me on a fact. So let's get that out of the way initially.
Okay, so the fact is I never worked for Carrie and Paul. I only worked for Carrie after she and Paul were already divorced. But I have a great story.
Good.
Because you were talking about my wonderful father, who was my wonderful father and a lifelong Yankee fan. He was in Yankee Stadium on July 4th, 1939, when Lou Gehrig, his idol, gave the speech.
Wow.
I'm the luckiest man in the world. He was there. He was a very young man. He was 18 years old. He was about to go off to war in the Marine Corps. But many, many years later, I went to a 2-game series between the Dodgers and the Yankees at Yankee Stadium. I had never been to Yankee Stadium, not the old one. I was in the new Yankee Stadium. But there was a 2-game series. And I didn't go to the first game. I went to the second game. The Yankees won the first game, but the Dodgers won the second game. And I saw Paul Simon up on the Tron, and he's a huge Yankee fan. So 2 nights later, as we would have it, I went out to Stamford, Connecticut, to see a show of Steve Martin, my employer, and Paul's wife, Edie Brickell, who not only made a record together, but also wrote a musical together that made it to Broadway called Bright Star.
Right.
And I said to Paul afterwards, I said, hey, I was at the game at Yankee Stadium, and I saw you up on the Jumbotron. And he said, oh, that was a terrible game. And I said, well, actually, it wasn't a terrible game for me. I said, because, you know, I'm a Dodger fan, and the Dodgers won the game. But I said, my father was a lifelong Yankee fan, and he was in Yankee Stadium when Lou Gehrig gave the speech, and I thought that Paul was going to cry. He was never old enough to have seen Gehrig play, but every Yankee fan idolizes Gehrig.
Sure. Yes.
So, fast forward, and I'll make this quick. July 4th, 2014, Stephen Eady and the Steep Canyon Rangers and the LA Philharmonic are playing a concert, 3-day 4th of July concerts at Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles. And I see Paul after the first night, and I was going to bring my dad on the 4th. And I see Paul after the first night, and I said, remember when I told you that my dad was in Yankee Stadium for the Gehrig speech? And he said, yes. I said, come back on July 4th, and he'll tell you the story. So on July 4th, we go backstage after the show. I introduce my father to Paul, and Paul says to my father, were there a lot of people there? And my father said, of course, there wasn't an empty seat. And then he said, were people crying? And my father said, well, everybody was crying. He said, even the players were crying. The only one who wasn't crying was Gehrig. And I have a photograph of my father, who was 6 feet tall, with Paul, who was 5'2", looking up at him as my father is telling him this wonderful story.
Oh, that's a great memory. Yeah.
It's a great memory. So, yes.
Yes, you said that he was a huge Yankee fan, but he actually isn't very huge. He's what, about 5'2"?
Yes, but he's a major Yankee fan.
Major Yankee fan.
Yes.
So refresh our listeners a little bit about your professional career.
Okay.
Your background.
So I grew up in Los Angeles. I'm a Jew from Boise, Idaho. My father was actually a radio announcer in Boise. He was a minor league baseball announcer and disc jockey. And they were on the verge of moving back to New York when my father got a job in Los Angeles. So I've lived in Los Angeles since I'm 4 years old. I'm 73 now. And, you know, I grew up there. And, of course, it's the capital of show business. And unlike many people who moved to Los Angeles, I never tried to work in show business. And then in 1985, through a series of coincidences, I met Carrie Fisher. And 3 months later, she asked me to come work for her. And I worked for her for a couple of years, and things didn't really work out there. And she told me some crazy story about, you know, she's going to be in New York, blah, blah, blah. We both knew it was crazy. And that night of that same day, she gave me 3 months to look for a job. She and Buck Henry, the writer, who became a good friend, went out to dinner with Steve and his then-wife, Victoria Tennant, Steve Martin and his then-wife, Victoria Tennant. And they'd been desperately looking for somebody, and they called me from the restaurant, and I went to see them the following morning, and I was without a job for less than 24 hours, and I worked for Steve for the next 34-plus years.
So what was the interview like?
Oh, that was great. Victoria conducted the interview because she told me if they ever had to let me go, she would have to do it. I outlasted her by about 25 years. But Steve came in and asked me 3 questions. He said, do you smoke? No. Do you like cats? Yes. Can you spell? Yes. And then he left the room, and that was the end. That was the end of his part of the interview.
Yeah, the cats were important, and the
no smoking apparently was as well. I went to work for them 2 weeks later, and a day and a half after I went to work for them, they gave me a key to their house full of priceless art, and they went off to Europe, and I had a new job. And
did you have any preparation for this type of job?
Oh, no, absolutely none.
Yeah, because what did you go to school for?
Oh, God. I mean, I got kicked out of college. I went to college.
That was prep. Yeah.
I went to college from 1968 to 1972 during prime time. I was in the SDS.
Right. Where?
Valley State, which is now Cal State Northridge, which was actually the most radical campus in Southern California. The most radical one in Northern California, of course, was Berkeley. But our campus was very radical, and I was involved with the most radical of the radical people there, and I got into trouble. You know, I was involved in the student strike in 1970, if you'll recall, when they shot the students at Kent State and the bombing of Cambodia. You know, we all shut down
good
universities.
Trouble.
Good trouble.
John Lewis.
All
yes.
over, you know, the country, and you know, also my, you know, I never went to class.
Right.
I majored in getting loaded, rioting, and hanging out. And so I got kicked out in 1972. And if I had ever found a reason to go back to college, I guess I would have. But I went, you know, I've read thousands of books, and I'm just natively intelligent. And so the thing that I did at work, people said to me, well, what do you do? And I'm like, I get things done, and I find things out. And I'm really good at it.
You're a sleuth.
I am. I'm good at doing. I can figure out how to do pretty much anything. And if I don't know, I know how to ask the right. One of the things that I've discovered about myself is that I'm neither competitive nor ambitious. I mean, it's just the truth about my nature. I'm just not that kind of a person. I mean, I could have eventually probably become an agent, a producer, something.
Right.
But I didn't want to work 16 hours a day, and I really didn't want to walk over other people in order to get, you know, promoted. I found a niche that worked for me.
Have you been in therapy, by the way?
Oh, yes, of course.
Okay. Do you think that's kind of something that really, like, helped pique your interest in saying, I could do this?
Yeah, but I have other things. I mean, I participate in a 12-step program.
Right.
I've sponsored many people over the years. I mean, I'm just a good practical problem solver. You know, that's what I am. I'm extremely practical, and I know how to solve problems.
Tell us about a particularly difficult problem that you were able to come up with a good solution for. I mean, I had many, many of them,
right.
I'm sure, dealing over all those years with Steve and his movie career and his TV career his recording career.
I agree with you, but I want to just real quickly, before we leave the therapy thing,
yeah.
I think the greatest thing about a therapist is they do help you problem solve. A good therapist is listening to you and helping, giving you tools to solve for these problems.
Well, for instance, the last time I was in therapy, I went there to help me retire.
Sure, right.
Okay.
What was that like?
Well, I went to therapy for 6 months. It was during the pandemic. I did therapy on Zoom with a therapist that was recommended to me. And she helped me with the transition. I started before I retired. I retired in December of 2021.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a year earlier than I wanted to. And the reason why I ended up retiring is because, you know, the pandemic started in March of 2020. My boss, Steve, basically lives in New York now. He has a young daughter who goes to school in New York. So they live there 9.5 months a year. Prior to the pandemic, I was flying to New York once a month for 9 months, and I would stay for a week to 10 days. So I was essentially bi-coastal, but I could get a lot of stuff done while I was on the ground in New York City. So I spent a lot of time in New York. Pandemic hit, I couldn't do that anymore. And it became evident to me, that they needed an assistant in New York. And I wasn't going to move to New York for another year or two. That just was not going to happen. So Steve came to me in the summer of 2020 and said, I'd like to ask you to retire at the end of 2021. And that was a little traumatic at first, you know, because I felt sort of hurt and, you know.
Right.
But I understood completely why that had to happen.
Right.
And so, you know, he did right by me at the end. I mean, I got a really nice bonus at the end, which actually kept me going for the next year. So, you know, but it was a huge loss for me, retirement, because it was a financial loss for one thing, but more importantly, it was a loss of status, prestige, access. I mean, working for somebody Steve Martin, you know, I had a lot of access to a lot of things that many people don't have any access to. I mean, you know, I knew people in the theater. I knew people in the movie business. I got to go to all kinds of events. You know, I went to the Academy Awards 3 times when he hosted. You know, I went to the Mark Twain Prize in Washington, D.C. when he got that. I went to a lot of shows.
How did the therapist help you deal with that? What were the practical tools they gave you to say, hey?
She got me to understand.
Yeah.
You know, and I was pretty good about it. I mean, I'm not a hysterical person. I mean, I think she got me to understand that it was going to be a different, but in some ways, you know, fulfilling life. I mean, you know, I kind of lost my sense of purpose, which I'm still sort of kind of trying to find.
Sure.
Because my mother died 11 years before my father, and I became my father's constant companion and towards the end his advocate. He lived to almost 97. And so I had that. That gave me a sense of purpose. My job gave me a sense of purpose. My 12-step program gives me a sense of purpose,
mm-hmm.
but it's not enough. You know, so I'm now almost 3 years in, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do next. I mean, I've taken classes. I go to the trainer. I go to lunch with people at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, I used to drive by cafes and think, who are those people eating lunch at 2 o'clock? And now it's me.
Right.
You know, but I I have to find something else to do.
Now, are you traveling at all? Do you do
Oh, yeah, I've traveled, absolutely. You know, I've done some traveling. You know, I went to Europe. I've been to New York, you know, every year. You know, I've sure. I come here to Missoula. You know, I want to go back to Europe. I have friends in France. You know, there are things to do. But also, you know, even though I have a very comfortable retirement, I can't just, you know, spend willy-nilly like I used to. I used to be able to just pretty much do whatever I wanted. But I've had to learn how to make those kinds of adjustments. And, you know, fortunately for me, I never thought that I was a big shot because I worked for Steve. You know, some people, when they work for a famous person, they almost think they're the famous person. I was never that person. Always. And I guess what the therapist did is it gave me perspective on what was going to be my new life, you know. And in the middle of it, I had an ill-fated romance, too, and she kind of helped me with that as well.
How great is that, though, that that's, like, good for you, right? Like, you're on to the next phase.
Yeah.
But you put everything into perspective, and it's like, you know, I understand because I moved from New York to here.
Sure.
And the access to things that I had 100% access to back east, this is just not here.
Well, but Arnie also, you know, before he moved to Montana, I mean, you know, he lived in the D.C. area. You were a mover and shaker in, like, international, you know, business. I mean, you know.
So what do you think you missed the most about the life that came to an end, you know, 3.5 years ago?
Well, I liked all the stuff because one of the things that he did, you know, towards the end of my career, which he's still doing in his career, is he started doing live shows.
Right.
And he started playing music again. And, you know, even though I went I went a lot on to movie sets and stuff like that. I've met a lot of famous people. You know, and at the end of my career, he said to me, well, who did you like the least and who did you like the most? And I said, well, some publicist who I told Arnie about that I got fired. But the people that I liked the most, I said, well, really, Marty Short and Eugene Levy, because they're Canadians, and they were the nicest to me. And also Diane Keaton, who's just, you know, like a fabulous person. And so they were very nice to me. But I also understood that they weren't my friends. But like when I would go to the shows, you know, I kind of loved when the stage manager would put a seat on the stage at, you know, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival in the shade and said, is this acceptable, Miss Waterstone? You know, it was kind of like that, you know, staying in some, you know, snazzy hotels, you know. I mean, I liked all of that stuff. I always flew business class to New York. You know, I mean, you know, I enjoyed the perks. I enjoyed those perks very, very much. But what I really loved was being able to go to, like, music festivals and see all these people play. I mean, music has always been a huge, huge part of my life. And so when he started playing music again, the other thing that really, really made me realize, like, what stratosphere I was in. So Steve stopped doing stand-up basically in 1982. He just quit. He talks about it in his book, Born Standing Up. He just stopped. He was the biggest comedian in the world. But people started, like, yelling out his punchlines, and it's hard to do comedy when you're doing that. And so many, many years later, he recorded a record, his first record in many years, called The Crow.
Mm-hmm.
Music for the 5-string banjo, and he started doing live appearances. Well, people came out, and they weren't necessarily bluegrass fans.
Right,
but
him.
But Steve Martin walked out on stage, and people literally lost their minds. I mean, and so most of the time when I worked for him, I used to think, yeah, he's that guy. But I really got to see, like, which guy he was when he would walk out on the stage. I mean, it was a revelation. I mean, people went crazy for him. So, and they still do.
So you mentioned, you know, he stopped doing live performances,
yes,
which was his, you know, everybody loved that.
Yes.
I never thought in that part of his career, I mean, I didn't know any intimate details of his life like you did, but I never thought that he would do a TV series and then only Murders in the Buildings come along and it's this huge hit.
Well, I wasn't very involved in it, sadly, because they started filming it during COVID, and I couldn't even go to New York or go to the set. So One of the reasons I think why he wanted to do this TV show, aside from the fact that it's clever and he was, you know, one of the people who, you know, came up with the idea. I mean, he's, you know, one of the, you know, developers of the show, is that so he lives in New York 9.5 months a year. He doesn't work in the summer. That's vacation. He comes out to California, has a house in Montecito where he stays most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But because he was one of the creators of the show and one of the executive producers, they shoot the exteriors in his neighborhood in the Upper West Side in New York, and they shoot the rest of it, I think, in studios in Astoria, Queens. He has a stipulation in his contract that he needs to be home in time to have dinner with his daughter. So he will never do another movie. It takes him away from home too much with his daughter. He and Marty go out and do maybe 6 dates a month for 9 months of the year. No dates in the summer because it's vacation. And it's a thing where he's able to do something that he loves very much, and it is a huge hit. And, you know, this season they've added even more people. I mean, I just recently went. Hulu had a huge premiere of the first episode of this new season on the Paramount lot, and I went. And Steve and Marty were there. Meryl was there. Selena was there briefly. I got to see Steve and Marty, which was really fun. And, you know, they had one of the buildings on the lot. You know, it looked just like the opening credits of the show with the lights up in the windows in that building in New York. And, you know, and so, you know, I got to at least participate in that. That was really fun. And, you know, those were things that I would have done as a matter of course. Actually, Steve didn't even think to invite me. An Australian journalist friend of mine invited me to go. But I got to see – I told Steve I was coming, and he was really happy.
What did he say to you after a few years? I mean, you've seen him since.
When you've been gone, right.
What did he say?
Well,
that you can share.
he did say something interesting. There's a new documentary out about him on Apple TV+. It's called Steve, giant letters, Martin, tiny letters. It's by Morgan Neville, who did Won't You Be My Neighbor and 20 Feet from Stardom.
Yes.
And the Anthony Bourdain documentary. It's a wonderful documentary, and it's called Then and Now. And then is the early part of his career and, you know, his stand-up and all of that, and now is his life today. So I actually had been interviewed for the documentary, but I got cut. But I know about a lot more people who got cut who are far more famous than I. So I don't feel that bad.
Sure.
I got a nice thank you at the end, which, you know, helped.
That's nice.
Helped salve my wound. But anyway, I wrote to him and I told him how much I enjoyed it. And he's very humble. He wrote back and he said, "It's hard for me to watch the first half." He said, "I wish I had been funnier." And then he wrote, "My new assistant is no you."
Uh-huh.
So he misses me.
That's the truth.
And
yeah.
I have had lunch with him twice this summer. Now they've gone back to New York. I was supposed to have lunch with him and the family, but unfortunately his daughter and his wife had COVID. But he didn't, thank God. So I was able to see him a second time. And we talk about books. You know, we talk about different audio books that we like listening to. We talked about politics. We talked about other things. And the other thing that happens now when he sees me, he hugs me.
Didn't do that before?
No, because of boundaries.
Really?
Yep. Yeah. I think he hugged me 4 times in 34 years. He hugged me. This is actually very funny. He hugged me when my mother died. He came to my mother's funeral and wore a yarmulke, which cracked me up. And only because my friend John told him he had to. It was like the only like light moment I had. The mourners filed by the family. And there's Steve, the whitest man in America, wearing a yarmulke, which just cracked me up. But anyway, I questioned my friend John later. And I said, "You told him he had to wear one, didn't you?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "You know he didn't have to." And I said, "Neither did you, since you're Greek." I said, "But you only wore one to cover up your bald spot." Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, for God's sake.
The time you're spending with him.
The hugs.
Right.
So
yeah.
He hugged me when my mother died. He hugged me for something else. I went to the AFI Life Achievement Award honoree thing,
right,
when he got his AFI Life Achievement Award, and all his friends were lined up to say hello, and he was hugging all of them. And then I got there and he hugged me, and then he looked surprised. And then the other time he hugged me was when I asked him if I could hug him after his wedding. which he permitted.
Yeah.
But otherwise, nothing.
Boundaries.
Right, boundaries.
But he always hugs me now. And I had a retirement lunch at his apartment in New York, which was just with the people I worked with and the family. It was just, you know, like 10 of us. And afterwards, we went into the living room, and his wife got up and recited a poem that she wrote about me. And then he and I both cried, and then he came over and hugged me.
Oh, that's sweet.
That's
it was very, very sweet.
Memory.
And the other thing that he said to me, when I was training my replacement, and she came out about 4 days out to California. She lives in New York, but she came out 4 days before. And then the family came out on the Friday, and she was off doing something. And Steve and I were sitting in the family room, and he said, "How's it going?" And I said, "It's great." I said, "She's really nice. She seems really smart." I said, "She likes all that computer stuff that I don't understand, like graphs and charts and stuff." And he said, "Don't put yourself down," which I wasn't. You know, right. I was merely stating a fact. And he said to me, "It's been wonderful, and everybody loves you."
Wow.
That's really nice.
You know,
what a great career. But that's an amazing career. And now you're on to the next phase.
Yes, right. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do. But I'm going to figure it out.
You know what's so amazing about Steve Martin, thinking about Steve Martin? Some of the best stories about Steve Martin are from other people telling stories in their documentaries. Like Bob Eisenstein, Super Dave.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't realize they worked together. On was it
not Eisenstein? Einstein.
Oh, yeah,
and he's Albert Brooks's brother, whose
right.
real name is Albert Einstein.
Or Albert Einstein.
Yes,
but
Arnie's cat.
Yeah. Or listening to Howard Stern talk about Steve Martin.
Yes,
he's held in such high esteem.
They
he's the
him.
Greatest comedian of our lifetime, and for most of our listeners, I mean, he's 79 years old now.
Yes.
For most of our listeners, their entire life, Steve Martin has been. And, you know, making them laugh in one form or another for their entire lives.
You know, you're talking about people who idolize him. So I'm friends with Chuck Lorre, the creator of The Big Bang Theory and other shows. And Steve was doing a personal appearance. There's like a lecture series or a distinguished speaker series or something. And he was doing one in Beverly Hills. And so Chuck asked me if I could get him tickets because he really wanted to meet Steve.
Chuck Lorre wanted
Chuck
to meet
Lorre
Steve
was
Martin.
Dying to
That's
meet
crazy.
Steve Martin.
It's one of the
I mean,
most
everybody
famous showrunners, the most famous showrunner in Hollywood.
Exactly,
right.
But they all, everyone who's involved in comedy, you know, they idolize Steve. They just do.
And it's crazy.
Yeah.
Do you feel like? Because here's the thing, right? So you've been retired. You don't have access to all these things. Okay, they are what they are. But your personal time, your own comfort, your own being able to do what you want to do on your terms, that's a pretty darn good thing to be able to have.
You know,
and to have earned.
It's great. I mean, you know, there are times I think, well, I'll start a little on-call assistant business. And then I think, I don't want to work. I don't want to work. But I want to do something, you know. So I'm going to figure it out. That's all.
Right.
I'm going to figure out what it is that I want to do. I will say this. I will be writing many postcards for Harris Walls, just to get in a little pitch, you know, because I can participate in that. So I can participate in doing what I can to help the campaign.
Well, because you're a single cat lady.
Correct. I'm a single cat lady, but I'm not childless. I do have a son and grandkids. However, I am I'm a total cat lady.
What if you know, let's pivot to that. Oh, Arnie, did you have something?
No.
I was going to say, let's pivot to...
Yes, let's.
Because you've always been politically active. Every time we've spoken about
and
politics.
And I'm very liberal.
And you're very liberal.
Yes.
And we, you know, what do you think's over the last 70 days? I mean, between the first debate and Biden, you know, essing the bed to everything that's happened since then.
It's unbelievable.
Take us back 90 days.
Sure.
What was your feeling about the first debate?
I couldn't even watch it. I had to read about it. I was so worried about it, and all my fears came true, yes.
Yep.
And I was very, very, very concerned because here we had a race between two old white men, both of whom, by the way, were losing it. Now, I don't draw the comparison between Biden and Trump. Obviously, Biden is the far better human being.
Right.
But, you know, I had great doubts about whether or not he was going to be able to beat Trump for a second time because he's losing it.
Right.
And it's acknowledged that he's losing it. And, you know, then I started seeing some hopeful signs because, you know, people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and the leaders of the Democratic Party were all, you know, expressing their concerns and their fears to him. And the day that he made the announcement that he was pulling out in favor of
that
Harris,
Sunday,
I got such a surge of hope.
As did I.
Now, I'm a Californian, so I have lived with Harris for a long time. She was our attorney general. She was a senator. I mean, and I have admired her for a very long time, and then she became vice president. So what I thought immediately was she's going to bring in young people. She's going to bring in people of color because she is both young and a person of color. By the way, she's my up-the-hill neighbor in Los Angeles. Just so you know, I've seen the motorcade, and they shut down the intersection right by
Brentwood,
where
right?
I live. I'm in Brentwood, right down right. the hill from where she lives. So then, you know, when they were all talking about the vice presidential pick, Tim Walz is the perfect pick.
Right.
I didn't know who he was.
You didn't want Shapiro.
No, I didn't want Shapiro, and I'm Jewish.
Right.
But for several reasons, not just because he's so ambitious, but also because he's a first-term governor. It's not his turn.
Right.
Walz has been, he's in his second term as a governor. He served right. six terms in Congress. He's a gun owner. He's a white guy. He's a coach.
Right.
And
he looks like a Republican.
And but he's so great. I mean, he's the guy that first started calling the other side weird.
Yeah.
Weird.
And it works, too.
And it works. And then we had the convention, which was such.
Well, what? Wait.
Okay.
You're skipping ahead.
Okay.
So Trump, okay, drops out. Trump gets shot.
He didn't.
Okay. What do you mean he didn't?
He got hit by a shard of glass from that teleprompter.
Okay.
If he had gotten shot by an AK-15 or 47 or whatever that gun was, they would have blown off the side of his
face.
It's funny
that you say that because they looked at the ear the other night with the Kamala debate, and I didn't see anything. Didn't...
Well, yes, because it didn't get shot off. If he had gotten shot by one of those weapons, he would have looked like Steve Buscemi in Fargo who got half his face blown off. I mean, the whole thing is that he never called the wife of the man who actually got shot and killed.
Really?
Biden called her, and she wouldn't speak to him because she felt that her husband, her dead husband, would disapprove of her speaking to Biden.
Which is nonsense.
Of course, it's insane.
Okay, so then.
But that's the cult.
Then we have the Republican convention.
Oh.
What did you think?
I didn't watch it, but I read about it. See, I won't watch certain things, but I will read about them in all the media. And all it was darkness, darkness, darkness.
Well, the first day, I watched every night.
Okay, you tell me about it.
The first day was, there's going to be unification, unity? I'm like, there's no way this lasts. And sure enough, once he started to speak, I mean, that's really when the S hit the fan.
Right.
And then it was just back to darkness, back to division.
Well, and his VP pick, what a nutbag. Jeez.
Okay, so now let's go to that. So he picks Vance.
He picks Vance.
And they really start to dig into all of his archive of nonsense.
Yes.
Which has been genius.
Well, and then also, you know, he started insulting cat ladies, which, you know, really
got... I'm a cat lady.
Which really got my dander up, let me tell you, because I got two cats living at home.
I know.
Yeah.
We're all cat ladies.
Yeah. Artie's been a cat lady.
He has been.
Yes.
But don't you... All right, so now, then we have the Democratic National Convention.
Oh, what a burst of adrenaline.
Okay, so how did you feel that went, and what were your thoughts?
Oh, I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was brilliant from start to finish, and I just have to say, I don't even know where they hid all those giant signs that people kept holding up. I mean, it was so well produced. It was so brilliant. I cried all the way through the roll call.
I agree.
I mean, I thought the speakers were magnificent. I thought probably the best speaker of all was Michelle Obama.
Yes.
Who very symbolically wore a sleeveless dress.
Yes.
You know,
to
and gave
guns.
And also, no more of that when they go low, we go high. She had the gloves off and she just told it like it was.
Yeah.
But I thought there were great speeches at our convention. I looked at our convention and all of the joy and all of the light and all of the hope, and I just thought to myself, what is wrong with these people that they still want to choose the other side?
Well, we still have a lot of work to do, but now let's go to her first interview with, right? Her first interview with she and Walls with Dana Bash.
Fabulous.
Right? She did well. She did no harm, right?
No.
But that's okay. Then we're recording this the week of the first debate, the second debate, but really the first debate between Kamala and Donald Trump. What are your thoughts post that? Because,
well, I have many.
Right.
First of all, she made a completely boss move at the beginning. She crossed the stage and forced him to shake her hand. And then she drew his hand back to her chest, which is what he does with everybody. So it was a boss move. It was a power play from the very beginning.
Kamala.
For Kamala.
Right.
And she owned him for the rest of the night.
Well,
she owned him.
And all she had to do was just lay the bait out there,
yep.
Right? This is the conversation, right? Crowd size. And then, yeah. But the jabs she got in are, like, stunning.
Well, right. And also she laughed at him, which he hates more than anything. And then she said that leaders all over the world were laughing at him, and the only one that he could pull out was Viktor Orban, the Hitler of Hungary.
It's true.
I mean, that's the world leader.
Arnie and I played a round of golf talking about this debate and what could happen and what, and I think everything that we talked about happened.
And then, of course, the dogs.
Oh, God.
Can we talk about the dogs?
Nobody could predict that. That was the surprise.
And he just kept doubling down on it. He saw it on TV. It must be true. They're eating the pets in Springfield, Ohio?
What did you think, Arnie? Yes. I haven't even talked to you about it since.
You know.
Sunday morning.
He is a known quantity.
Right.
And you know he has to take the bait. Someone described it as somebody who has one of those laser pointers and he's chasing the dot all over the place. He is constitutionally unable not to take the bait and go after things that that fit into his mental state. You know, if you question the crowd size, I'm bigger, better, I know everything, I'm smarter, everybody supports me.
He's better
looking.
All the
economists. I'm better looking than. But here's the. There are if you're running against the Democratic incumbent, and now you're running against the Democratic incumbent's vice president. In the history of this country, virtually no winning candidate has ever gotten much more. In most cases, less than 60% of the vote. There's always 40%.
Right.
It's always a fight for 10%, one way or the other.
It's a sliver.
Yeah, and sometimes even less than 10%. Sometimes it's down to 2%.
So bring us to today. We still have a ton of work to do.
Well, there are legitimate issues the opposition party could logically lay out that voters are concerned about the economy and how the current administration handled the economy, inflation, which are always the bread and butter issues. You have foreign policy and the Israeli situation. They have the worst possible spokesperson that you can imagine to try to articulate those issues to undecided voters.
Right.
And the more he tries to address that stuff by calling her comrade, Kamala or whatever.
Right.
That doesn't do anything for the votes they need to win. This is all about 80,000 votes in Pennsylvania and 40,000 votes in Nevada and 90,000. And they have the worst possible vehicle to convey the message that they want to convey.
But for people that aren't as politically astute as all three of us are, he is the default choice.
Well, and he's got a vice president who's a surrogate for whatever he's saying because he can't not be because he gets fired. As Trump said, if anybody disagrees with him, they're out.
And then he's got like these two people that have signed on that's like the most bizarre. Robert Kennedy Jr.
Right.
and Tulsi Gabbard, who supposedly is like such a hawk for the military, and all this guy does is disparage the military.
I know.
I mean, what is that about? I mean, we all know that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is insane.
Right.
But I'm not sure what the Tulsi Gabbard thing is.
But all of what you're saying is true.
Yeah.
That still doesn't mean that those 80,000, 20,000 are going to...
Of course. I mean, I don't...
This is what scares me.
Well, of course.
Well, look, it's all about at this
How
point...
How do we ensure?
All at this point is voter turnout. That's all the election is down. I mean, it's scientific at this point. I worked on two presidential campaigns. You have to turn out X amount of votes per precinct in order to win. And that's what it's down to. So the question is, what can you do to mobilize your base? Trump believes that this continued barrage of attacks and incriminations and lies, which, you know, even Fox News points out all the lies, mobilizes his base. But his base is capped. You know, some of the smartest Republican operatives I know, basically he's capped.
Right. Because didn't you have a sit down with Ron Brownstein?
Yeah, Ron Brownstein.
Brownstein.
And one of McCain's
Recently.
Former people. Yeah. He's capped. He's got to get other people to come out.
And I don't think they want to.
And they don't want to because it's still, you know.
But can she still get enough people out?
Well here's question. An interesting point. Just to say, Cat Lady, Taylor Swift,
right,
makes an endorsement right after the debate. She gets like 2 million likes on her Instagram, and now about 350,000 people have registered to vote.
Or they've gone to the site, but they haven't registered.
Well, but okay, they will. Right. Well, I think
20% of them registered, 70,000.
But I think the Swifties will vote. You know, because now she has the endorsement of Taylor Swift, who has an enormous following. And I actually laughed out loud. I saw a headline of an article, I think it was in People magazine, where Trump says Taylor Swift made a terrible, she's going to really pay, you know, for endorsing Kamala Harris.
And Trump has the Hulk and Kid Rock, but the base for those people are already in.
Right,
Taylor's going to be changing now because they're...
And Kamala Harris has Taylor Swift and Beyonce.
But she's not going to have a problem with... Everyone says this, if you listen to the pundits.
Right.
It's not women that they're going to have the problem with. It's men.
It's white men.
That's why Tim Walz was such a brilliant choice.
True.
You know, this is all fractions of numbers. This is going to be, you know...
Counties.
Well, I mean, you got to remember, last time Biden won by 7.5 million votes.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
But... The Electoral College caused, you know, difficulty.
We really need to abolish that thing.
Well, we need to do that.
We need to abolish that thing. We really,
created,
need to abolish
you know, it.
I don't care.
I know.
Doesn't mean it anymore.
No, it was created to placate the South after, you know, around the time of slavery so that they could have, the North had much larger population and they were afraid that all their economic vitality was going to be taken away by the North.
Wow.
So they created the Electoral College in the simplest form.
Well, I resent living in California and having to pay for those dumb people in the red states at this point, you know. I mean, California is the sixth largest economy in the world.
What was it like? So tell us what it was like with her as your senator and as your AG.
Well, I mean, I thought she was great. I thought that, you know, she's a great prosecutor, which made her fantastic.
At the debate.
At the debate. Because she's not intimidated by him at all.
I know.
Not
great.
One bit, you know. And, you know, as a senator, I don't know that I paid, like, all that much attention. But I have paid attention to her as vice president. And I think that she's very smart. She's very energetic. You know, I mean, you know, when she was elected on that ticket, you know, to watch her, you know, striding, you know, through the halls of Congress as the vice president, or down the hallway and, you know, in the White House. I mean, that was really something, you know?
Sure.
I mean, what a barrier to break down. And I honestly think she stands an enormous chance of being elected president, and she's going to break down. Well, Obama was the first black president, but she's also South Asian, and she's a woman.
Right.
I mean, it's about time.
Agreed.
That we have a woman.
So the question for the Republican side is, if they believe that their party, putting Trump aside, is better on the issues, you know, can solve the, you know, inflation, can solve the economic downturn or whatever, you know, are they better off than 4 years ago? I mean, you got to remember, 4 years ago, there were people being, you know, put in body bags into, you know, ambulances right. on the street, and, you know, things weren't that great. Trump left office with a 37% popularity. I mean, that was the, you know, that was the polling at the time. But if they figure, if they feel they're better off with a Republican policy perspective, including 2025, the report that's been prepared, which may or may not be fully adopted by the party, but
I love that he I love that he denied having anything right, to do yeah, with that.
Disavowed.
But yeah. Can the undecided voters, can the people that will make the difference, separate the messenger from the message?
Because there's always a worse economy under Republicans, and people don't realize that.
No, but I'm saying, that, can they separate his dark and negative view, as Eileen said, of the country, which isn't true? This is the greatest economy in the world, and people would, most people in the world would love to come here. That's why we have so much immigration from so many
countries.
It's
a failing nation, he says.
Yeah, I mean, do you want somebody, your spokesperson, to talk about all this negativity?
No.
No, but can a voter, can an undecided voter say, look, I don't like the vessel, I don't like what he has to say because he's, you know, whatever, but I support the policy, so I'm going to vote for the party.
Right.
The problem is the party can't control the spokesperson.
No.
And it's been proven that that's the case.
I agree with you. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. Our guest is Eileen Waterstone. She is a return guest here on What Do You Know? I'll posit this. I'll ask you both this. Does he make it to the election? Back after this. All right. We are back with Eileen Waterstone. All right, Eileen. Does he make it to Election Day, Donald Trump?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't really know. Of course, my hope is that he won't.
There's a lot of, you know, a lot on the table and a lot at stake with this.
Yeah.
If he gets elected, he's immune from prosecution as the president of the United States. And that's important for him because he's indicted. You know, he's found guilty.
He's a felon.
There's a sentencing waiting for him on at least one thing. The January 6th case will be heard. If he is, you know, if he's not the president, he'll probably serve time, is my guess, based on everything I've read and seen. If he gets elected, he doesn't. So everything for him is
it's riding on this.
But he cannot control his personality enough to try to modulate, to try to appeal to some people that he needs to get to vote for.
It's been 9 years. He won't do it. I don't think he makes it. You think he makes it. Eileen is unsure. Last minute and a half. What do we think about this whole Russian disinformation campaign that's been happening through social media? It's much larger than people had.
2,800 people involved in the disinformation
campaign. Give us a quick synopsis of that, Arnie, because you and I
think you're the one to answer this question.
But that's incredible that this has happened.
With your Russian experience.
You know, with my Russian experience, comrade.
Yes.
How does that happen, though? So the Russians money. Are paying.
It's all about money.
Social influencers.
They pay social influencers. Many of the social influencers are not well-established morally, you know, have moral imperatives behind them. They're to make money.
Right.
They're on social media to get how many clicks, and you make money off of it.
Right.
Someone gives you $1 million and says, I want you to read this or type this and send it out. What do they care?
Okay.
They're doing a lot worse things for a lot less money on other topics.
Well, there's all kinds of hacking as well.
Right. There's all the hacking and AI.
So the dark days of the disinformation is happening. Last question.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just think about this for 1 second. What happens to the GOP if he doesn't make it? Who turns the page on the GOP? Who's the leader?
I think this signals the end of the GOP. I think they're going to have to create an all new political party.
I think
that. And who leads that?
Liz Cheney.
Okay, that's a good guess. That's a good prediction.
I don't think the party dissolves itself. I think, like many parties, they go to a different leader. They may have to go to a more moderate if they want to win at the national level. There's probably some bright Republican out there, you know, like a senator from Maryland or, so, you know, somewhere. Mitt Romney type guy. A guy 20 years younger than Mitt. Mitt 77.
Larry Hogan, you're thinking.
Larry Hogan.
Okay.
Could bring
right.
the party
I
into a more stream. More mainstream approach to America.
But I'm liking Liz Cheney, and I never thought I'd like a Cheney. Oh, and one other thing. Dick Cheney has endorsed Kamala Harris. What the heck?
These are bizarre days. Eileen, you're a great guest. I love the fact that you came here to talk to us. We talked about Steve Martin and politics.
It's always been great coming here. I'm really happy to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Arnie.
Hey, as always, cousin.
All right. I'll see you next Sunday, Arnie.
Next Sunday. Go Grizz.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.